With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning into the 282nd episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast, which is brought to you today by Hulu's original limited series, The Act, which stars Joey King and Patricia Arquette in a gripping story based on real events and is now streaming for your Emmy consideration. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is currently the toast of Broadway. He's a versatile young actor who has starred on screens big and small, but is best known for his work on the stage, and is currently nominated for the Best Actor in a Musical Tony for his dual portrayal of Michael Dorsey and Dorothy Michaels in the first ever musical version of Tootsie, which is playing 8 times a week at the Marquee Theater. Santino Fontana. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of Polk & Company, the PR firm representing Tootsie, the 37-year-old and I discussed the importance of his years as a student in a BFA program that brought together the University of Minnesota and the Guthrie Theater, how he began making his name on Broadway, only to have his career interrupted and his life jeopardized by an injury that he sustained during a 2010 performance of A View from the Bridge, how he rebounded in 2013 with the parts of two princes, one on Broadway in Cinderella, for which he received a Best Actor in a Musical Tony nomination, and the other in Frozen, the Disney animated film that became an international phenomenon, and a couple of years later as the love interest on the CW show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. How, most recently, he wound up wearing a dress and high heels and singing like a woman as the star of a show now garnering rave reviews, making more than $1 million a week, and currently nominated for 11 Tonys, plus much more. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Santino, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you. We always begin with just a few basics. Where were you born and raised, and what do your folks do for a living?
I was born and raised in Stockton, California, in San Joaquin Valley, and moved when I was 10 to Washington State, to Richland, Washington. My father is an agronomist, or was, he's retired now, and my mom was a teacher and a counselor, high school counselor.
For people like me who are listening, can you just clarify what an agronomist is?
Sure, it's like a combination of an economist and an agriculturalist. Okay. So it's basically, he worked with farmers to help optimize their crops.
Okay, so growing up, it sounds like most of the formative years would have been in Washington.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
And that, you know, they're apparently around a large Mormon population.
Yeah.
What sort of exposure was there to theater and the arts and whatever there?
I mean, not a lot, because there was no, well, both in both towns, and I was in California until I was 10, and then I was in Washington from 10 to 18. There was no professional theater or professional music, any performing arts, visual, any arts, any professional. There were no, there were none of those. So, there was a temple, a Mormon temple in my hometown, and a very large percentage of our...
You're not Mormon, are you?
No, I'm not.
So were you...
I was raised Catholic.
Were you able to participate in the, whatever the productions or whatever the temple was doing, or that was just...
Oh, I don't even know. You can't go in the temple if you're not Mormon. So I've never been in a temple. I've driven by it.
Right.
No, but there were always, you know, there were community theater productions. There were school productions.
Yeah.
That was the majority of what I did. There was a children's theater that I was in the very first production of in Washington. Mm-hmm. And there was like a community college where they did productions that the community could audition for.
So in terms of the idea that acting could actually be a long-term pursuit, I mean, the closest thing to that I, in prepping for this, that I came across, how would your grandfather keep you busy?
Yeah, my grandfather, he babysat for me a lot, especially when we lived in California. Mm-hmm. And he would go to Blockbuster back when they rented, rented movies, which is, and he would just rent the movies that he loved, and we would just watch them, and then we would just watch them on repeat and repeat and repeat, and they were a wide range of, you know, 12 Angry Men and Bridge Over Kwai and Singing in the Rain and, you know, Abbott and Costello and all that stuff.
And what did you take away from that, that they're, you know, just that the memorization, or what was the value of that for you?
I think seeing how much joy it brought him, and that was infectious, and he is an infectious character himself, my grandfather. But seeing that, and also kind of falling in love with that ability to be taken away into an imaginary world and, you know, feel something and think about it and learn something, and also having shared that experience with the people you were with when you watched it.
So as you prepared to go out into, I guess, college years, how did your folks feel about this becoming a actual line of pursuit? Because I know, I guess we should just tell people, you ended up at the University of Minnesota in this, at that point, brand
first
new
year.
Program. Yeah,
yeah,
BFA,
yeah,
associated with the Guthrie Theater.
Mm-hmm. My parents were never anything but supportive, even to probably fault. Like, there was never no, they never said no. And they also were the first to admit that they didn't know the first thing about this or anything about it, or how realistic it was to pursue it, or what it looked like, or if it was smart or not. So that said, they never stopped me, and they never, they really did follow my lead.
Definitely. So you go off now to Minnesota to do this program. What were the biggest takeaways of those years on route to the BFA coming out, I guess, in 04?
Mm-hmm. Huge, you know, life-changing. I mean, I do feel like I was really lucky. I went to Interlochen Arts Camp for a summer. That led me to this scholarship competition called Young Arts, which where I met, and Anthony Rapp was just at the show the other night. He was one of my judges, as was this man named Kenneth Washington, who founded the program in Minneapolis. And he kind of, you know, took me by the hand and said, I think he was the first person to ever tell me that I was an actor, and that if I didn't pursue that first, I would be a mistake. And I trusted him. You know, those 4 years at school, which we were the guinea pigs of because we were the first class.
19 kids, right?
Yeah. We started with 19. We ended with 15.
Wow.
And about the importance of what we're actually doing, and to get your head on straight of like why we're doing this, what we're doing, what's important about it, what's not, and then how to prepare yourself in as many ways as possible to be able to play as many different people as possible and for a long career and life in the arts, which is not, you know, I don't think a lot of people talk about that often. So I feel really lucky to have had him as a mentor and that place at that time, especially because we were all figuring it out.
Yeah. Well, it seems from the timeline that I don't know if you stayed in Minnesota or came back, but one of the first big roles out of school was back at the Guthrie, right?
Yeah, I tried to move here. I graduated in 2004. I was hired for three shows at the Guthrie, Death of a Salesman, Christmas Carol, and As You Like It.
Yep.
And then I was also asked to, I directed something that they had seen, and Joe Dowling asked if I would assistant direct His Girl Friday with Angela Bassett and Courtney Vance.
Wow.
Who I ended up like running lines with them in their apartment. They became very close, and Courtney then helped me when I moved to New York. But 2005, I went to the Sundance Theater Labs as an apprentice through the Young Arts program. This is so technical and boring.
This is great.
But, no, so I went there and I was in a show that Kate Wariski directed and a show that Michael Greif directed based on the Andrew Cunanan story. And I had small roles in both of those.
Right.
But I met a lot of great people like Harriet Foy and Michael Greif and Emily Swallow and Peter Dubois was up there. So I kind of met all these people. And then I was like, I'm moving to New York right after this. And I came to New York and I lucked out because I got a couple like auditions through those connections.
Yeah.
Which very quickly, then it got much harder very quick. And then I did the whole, you know, open call thing. And then started auditioning for Hamlet at the Guthrie.
How does that work? You're going to go back to Minnesota?
I auditioned, I think, four times. Well, I think the first one was here.
Okay.
So Joe came out with Pat. And I think, I don't remember, but Pat McCorkle who cast it. But there were four or five auditions for that. Ended up doing all the soliloquies. And they ended up flying all of us to Minneapolis to do it on the stage. Because the theater is a huge thing.
Yeah.
And there's no mics and... They want to see,
like,
can you really do it?
Yeah.
That production was in 2006.
So that's a big deal to be playing Hamlet at, what were you,
23? Yeah. Yeah.
People wait a whole career to do that.
I know.
How did you, was it too soon or were you happy with how it went? Or what?
I was happy with it. I mean, I was proud of it. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are things now I wish that I think back. I mean, the irony is too, when I found out, when I got the phone call that I got it, I haven't really told this story yet. In the Marriott Marquis, which is where Tootsie is playing now.
Yes.
There is a lounge, a concierge lounge, where they give out free food. And a buddy of mine, who we'd both moved here in 2004, 2005, he was like, there's this place where you can get free food at the Marriott Marquis. You just have to sneak in. So we would go and sneak in for, you know, off so many times, weeks, months at a time. I can't tell you how much time I spent there. Enough that we had backstories. I was prepared if someone confronted me that I was Bill Marriott's nephew. And if they asked for my key, I would be like, you know, I'm Bill Marriott's nephew.
Yeah, don't mess with me.
Yeah. And then like, can I get your name? Right. Just like all the ways to like scare them so that they would avoid it. Because you can't be wrong. They don't want to be wrong.
Right.
So I got the phone call while we were there. On my cell phone, God. And I was basically stealing food from the Marriott Marquis.
And now
we're doing the show there. And then, funnily enough, like 4 or 5 years ago, I was the voiceover for Marriott.
No.
Yes, it was.
Like a TV commercial or something.
Yeah, you've seen it. I'm sure I have. You've definitely seen it and heard it.
You can't make that up.
Anyway, so then I got back and, did Hamlet the Guthrie in 2006.
And then moved to New York for good.
Yeah. Then it was like, okay, let me try it again.
Because now, with that credit, does that help your standing here?
I mean, does it? I don't know. I mean, it didn't hurt.
Yeah.
I'll say that. It didn't hurt. But, you know, New York is a different animal, and it's a beast.
Well, so that was also in 2006 that you came back here, right? And somehow, by 2007, you're making your Broadway debut in a revival of Sunday in the Park with George. So connect the dots.
Okay, here we go. So 2006, Hamlet of the Guthrie and Mel Marvin, who's a composer, he did the music, the underscoring for Hamlet.
Okay.
And he is also friends with Tom Jones, who wrote The Fantastics.
Right.
Not the Welsh pop star. So he said, you know, they're doing a revival of The Fantastics. It closed and now they're reopening it at a new theater in Midtown. I think you should audition for this. And it was, couldn't be anything more different than Hamlet than The Fantastics.
Yeah, no.
So I was like, yeah, why not? So I lucked out in getting an audition right away from that. And then I left that after 4 months like an idiot, because I was like, well, it's like a regional theater gig. It's 4 months, I'm done. Everyone else was like, why are you leaving?
Yeah.
I was like, what do you mean? We did it. And then I went out to the Old Globe and I did Hay Fever. And then I came back and did Sunday in the Park.
Just a regular audition.
Yeah, totally regular audition. Yeah, absolutely. Didn't know anybody. Jim Carnahan didn't know me. I think it was the first, no, that was after, there was, you know, again, full circle. There was a workshop of The Flamingo Kid, which is now up at Hartford Stage in their musical.
Right.
Henry Krieger had written the music and Michael Mayer was directing and James Magruder had written the book. And I had a cold audition for it and met Jim Carnahan through that, which I ended up getting. Didn't go anywhere, obviously. And now a whole different team is writing it. But that's how I met Jim Carnahan, who then brought me in for Sunday in the Park, which was just an audition.
Yeah. I think what, you know, having mentioned these first few credits, somebody who isn't familiar with you before this might say, wait a minute, so he's doing Hamlet and then he's singing and he's doing this. What I read that kind of blew my mind was that in college, where by that time, apparently it was already clear, at least to you, that, you know, you were a better than normal singer, right? probably by quite a lot, even at that point. You didn't want people to know that you sang.
Yeah, I tried to hide it.
Why?
Yeah. Because, for the same reason that we're talking about it right now. Everybody wants to put everybody in a box. It's human nature. We all have biases, and everybody wants to do that. And one of the things that Ken always, you know, rammed in my head was, the world is going to try to limit you. Mm-hmm. Don't limit yourself. Mm-hmm. And the second you say singer, or if you even say classical actor, or you say, you know, comedy actor, or you say dramatic actor, everyone suddenly has images and ideas of who you are.
And aren't.
And I don't want any of that. I also recognize as I go on, it only gets harder in some respects. However, people who have done their homework and know, well, wait a minute, I saw him in Sons of the Prophet or I saw him in Hamlet. That's also now part of my job. So it's an extension of that. I came to the Guthrie Theater, you know, which started with Zoe Caldwell and Hume Cronin and Jessica Tandy and George Grizzard, some of the best actors that have ever played this country. And I was going there to study to be an actor. So the idea that I was going to complicate it, I didn't want to do that.
And maybe it helped that you weren't like a musical theater kid, because you would have limited yourself.
Maybe. At Young Arts, at that scholarship competition, for example, you pick three pieces. I sang a song from West Side Story. I did a David Ives monologue, and I did a monologue from The Seagull. And Ken, when he said, "I think you're an actor, and it'd be a mistake if you didn't pursue this," mm-hmm. he said, "Why did you pick The Seagull?" Mm-hmm. It was strange.
Yeah,
and I now see, but it's also incredibly representative of who I am and who I want to be.
Right.
It's a challenge, you know, especially when what we're trying to do as artists, as actors, you're trying to inhabit other people's skin. And the very idea of that has no limits on it.
Right.
So why would you then try to categorize, especially today, right. everything is categorized, uh-huh. everything is specialized. So to fight that is a challenge, but also I feel like a necessity.
Right. What do you remember of that first night, the Broadway debut in Sunday in the Park?
Oh, I was very excited and very nervous. And I remember it feeling very kind of like, yeah, it was super. And also that cast was great. And I loved all
those
people.
Who were some of the others?
Oh, Daniel Evans and Jenna mm-hmm. Russell and Michael Kumsty and Jessica Mulaski and Ann Nathan. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could go on.
Yeah.
It was a great group of people. And Sam Buntruck, who became a friend, who was the director. Alex Gimignani was in it. Yeah, it was a great. And that score, it's great.
Yeah.
So really cool.
So from there, you went into, I think, what would have been the longest run in anything up to that point with Billy Elliot, like 10 months.
Yeah.
You were the brother, sort of political guy in a show that gets very well received, right? I mean, that was what does it feel like? Now you're certainly experiencing it again with Tootsie, but, you know, to be sort of part of the toast of Broadway, that's can you breathe a little at that point when up to that point it seems like it's just, you know, can I join the club? Now you're sort of in it.
I think, no. I mean, no, I hate to, it's so hard to talk about. I mean, I feel like what I will say, it added to the arsenal of experiences of understanding what the life of an actor is or can be. Mm-hmm. And Billy Elliot could not have been more different than Sunday in the Park mm-hmm. or anything I'd done up to that point. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, still.
Yeah.
There were three boys that alternated who were all amazing dancers.
What were their ages?
Oh, I think 9 to 11 to 12, something in there.
Yeah.
And there were 40, I want to say, I can't remember, I think 40 people in that cast and like 20 children, like with child guardians and teachers and... Yes, it was huge.
Yeah, yeah.
And they'd also already done it in Australia, and mm-hmm. they'd done it in London, and it was a movie. And
you got it on the basis of Sunday in the Park? Or
no, I had an audition.
Okay.
I had an audition. And I was excited because he didn't sing. Because people in Sunday in the Park were like, oh, wow, you were beautiful, pretty. We didn't know you sang. I was like, yeah, great. And then, I used to have a joke, especially when I was starting out. If the character had an accent or cry, I would get it.
Because you were always good at accents?
I don't know. I don't know why. It became like a joke. Like, right. Does the character cry? I was like, I don't know. Again, I think that goes back to like the Guthrie Theater stuff of you want to be able to do everything. There's no dialect any person who knows the international phonetic alphabet can't learn.
Right.
So this idea of this Geordie accent, which no one had heard,
right.
and really there are very few people in America ever hear it.
Yeah.
That was exciting to me. And it was exciting to be able to be like kind of a guy in a straight play surrounded by dancing dresses, you know?
So then I think you did something that I don't know if you had done before where you believe.
I'm kind of terrified by your research, by the way. I love it. I'm both honored and terrified and scared to death.
What's coming?
I know what's coming. We're going in order.
Right.
It's very nice. Oftentimes, you know, people ask me like, so how long have you been acting? Like, get me a gun right now. Not for him, for me. Yeah. So I appreciate it.
My pleasure. So Brighton Beach Memoirs, where you personally got the first recognition that you're saying is not what it's all about, but it's still nice.
It's not all about.
2010 Best Featured Actor in a Play Drama Desk Award. Again, an older brother character.
Yeah.
And everyone from George Clooney to whoever, the people audition using scenes from Brighton Beach Memoir. Why is that such a pleasure for actors?
That part is an amazing part, first of all. Stanley. Yeah. I will say also with that experience, which, you know, we closed in a week, it was still great. I mean, I was texting with Laurie Metcalf the other day. Noah Robbins, who played my brother, he's one of my best friends still. Jessica Hecht and I are neighbors. Manny Eisenberg, I call for advice still to this day. Like, what do you think about this? David Cromer came and saw the show. I've done multiple readings of things of his with him since then. It's a great, first of all. And he got to meet Neil Simon.
There you go.
Hang out with Neil Simon. Neil Simon called me Santo because he said Santino was too long. You know what I mean? And like my audition, after my audition, Jay Binder also I owe a lot to, because I was Jay Binder's reader for years. And he, I think I was the first person they saw, and he knew I could do it. Mm-hmm. And I knew I could do it. Mm-hmm. And it's a tricky part. There's a lot of dramatic stuff, but there's also, you got to land all those jokes.
Right.
As brief as it was, that was a great, at times tumultuous, but great experience. Dennis Boutsakaris, I also am still in touch with all the time.
So that was a short run for one reason. The next one, A View from the Bridge, was a short run for another.
Yeah.
What the hell happened?
Oh, God. Well, the good news is, and I'll start with this, I'm fine now. I will tell you, and again, in this idea of like adding experiences to your arsenal, mm-hmm. I mean, even what we just talked about, you add in Brighton Beach Memoirs, how can a Neil Simon comedy close in a week when the reviews were pretty good, mm-hmm. from what I heard? I don't really read reviews, but pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Going into, okay, now you're going to play love interest opposite Scarlett Johansson with Liev Schreiber. Awesome. With Jessica Hecht, who was in Brighton Beach.
Right,
fantastic. Right. And then I hit my head. And
How did that happen?
It was in a scene, in the middle of a scene. Which is, it's a physical scene. I mean, if you go back also through the history of that play, it's cursed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I had a great casting director who will remain nameless. After I came out on the other side, she closed the door. I came in the office, her office. She closed the door and she said, "You got to that show with your life." And she walked me through all the people from other... Frank Langella told me a story of he had played Rodolfo and he had gotten injured as well. Like, it's a physical, it's about a working class group of people. And
but your injury was severe enough to like knock you off for...
Yeah, I had the contusion on my brain the size of a baseball. And it landed right in the center of my skull, on the side of my skull where it's fortified. And the doctor literally showed me the MRI and said, half an inch to the left or to the right and you'd be dead.
Was it a fall or a hit?
No, it was in fight choreography within the show.
During a performance or during
during a performance, during a preview.
What happened?
I finished the show.
You finished the show?
And I did five shows after that because I'm an idiot.
Well, so were you just in massive pain or you didn't realize how...
No, the thing about a brain injury, about this one in particular, well, first of all, I don't think there was any level of pain I would have called out with. Mm-hmm, you know, that's also part of like learning your life as an actor. You don't do that.
Right.
So I hit my head. I tried not to make a big deal out of it because I was like, it's probably fine. I called a buddy of mine who was in medical school in the city, who is from Richland, Washington, who's still one of my best friends. And I said, I hit my head. I feel kind of weird. And he asked, have you thrown up? I'm like, no. He was like, are you alone? Is anyone staying with you tonight? And I was like, no, I'm alone. He was like, if you throw up, call me back. If you don't, you're fine. I fall asleep. I wake up 4 hours later. I throw up. And then I fall back asleep.
That's dangerous.
Yes, exactly right.
Yeah.
I call the company management. They send a doctor who says I'm fine, which I'm not. Rosemary Tischler, great casting director, and Jessica Hecht both kind of pull me aside within those five shows, and they say, you need to go see another doctor.
Did they notice that, whether it was your speech or something?
They said, you seem a little out of it.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them, because I felt one of the symptoms of post-concussive syndrome is you feel kind of drunk all the time.
Yeah.
You're kind of loose. You can't really follow things the way you used to. However, you have no problems with things you already have in your brain.
Right.
It's new information that you can't handle. So the show was fine. It was when we would be talking about notes or I'd be trying to answer questions that I realized something is not right.
Obviously, the most pressing thing was your health, but to have to withdraw from such a
major
production, was it upsetting on that level as well?
Oh, it's not just upsetting. It was terrifying. The doctor said to me, the doctor who showed me the MRI asked if I had any non-cognitive skills. Yeah, add that one up. What does that mean?
Yeah.
So I was like, what do you mean, like a bricklayer? Yeah. Can I be a bricklayer? He was saying,
he was saying that you're going to have brain damage.
That you may not recover.
Oh, my God.
Every brain injury is different. So some people do not get back to where they started, and some people do. He said, if you came in from the street, this is so dark and depressing. I apologize to the listeners. I'm fine now. I'm going to say it again. I'm fine now. But at the time, there was a year where we didn't know, where I had to do cognitive therapy crap of, you know, memory games and all that to see, am I going to be able to get this back? Which is when Sons of the Prophet stepped in, which the last line of that play is, I'm having a bad year. And about a character who thinks he's dying.
Right. So the reading was for a show that, of course, goes on to be a finalist for the Pulitzer and all this. But forget about it. That's a long way back from where you were.
Damn straight. They literally told me, they said, the doctor was like, we could hospitalize you, but it's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
Or you can be in your room, but it needs to be dark for 3 weeks.
That's
so I was in a dark room in Brooklyn for 3 weeks. And I had friends come and give me meals, and like the guy who I hung out with at the Marquee.
Yeah. yeah, he was picking it up there.
Yeah, yeah. No, really. And it was, listen, I wouldn't wish that on anybody, but I will say it made who I am now mm-hmm. 10 times stronger. And also it made it so clear what's important mm-hmm. and what is not.
Well, I think that it was also two other things happened that right about that. So that was 2010 that you mm-hmm. came back. You're doing the reading.
Yeah.
That show, I guess, ends up happening in 2011.
Yeah, I did Importance of Being Earnest. That's right before that. With Brian Bedford, yeah.
And then I guess on a personal note, something else, I think you met your now
wife. I met my wife during Importance of Being Earnest, the second half of it.
So things were turning around, I guess, from where they were.
Well, I didn't have many options. No, it was either like worse. Disappear or things are going to get better. Right, right. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so 2013 is the year of the princes for you because yep. I don't know which project came about first. Probably Frozen, right?
You know, I think it was they really overlapped. Yeah. I had auditioned for Tangled and then...
this is the movie from Disney.
Yes, and then later on... They called me in for, I think it was called Snow Queen. It was a different script, mm-hmm. different story. And I was in the callbacks for that, and then it fell apart. And then months later, Frozen, different character, different audition. And that there were several auditions to that as well. And I think it had started while the workshops of Cinderella had begun.
This is now, we're talking Cinderella on Broadway.
Yes.
And so you were on Disney Films radar,
yes,
independent of you doing Cinderella. It wasn't that
Jamie Roberts, the great casting director who's a friend of mine as well. She saw me in Billy Elliot.
Okay,
she brought me in from Billy Elliot. She saw me in Billy Elliot. She ran into me in the street right after with Katie Lowes, ironically, the TV actor and great actor, not just TV, theater, film.
Yeah,
they're friends as well. Ran into me on the street and they were like, "Do you want to go get some food?" We went and hung out, hit it off. They were asking me all these similar questions you're asking. And then she called me back in. And so I was on her radar.
Yeah.
But, you know, then, yeah, exactly. And I think the end of the workshop of Cinderella in 2012, I mm-hmm. want to say, coincided the day it finished, the workshop finished. Laura Osnes took the cast to a frozen yogurt place.
Yep.
And I got the phone call while we were there.
While you were there.
That I got. Frozen.
That's awesome.
I'm going to be the villain.
Well, so, yeah, the Cinderella prince is the good prince, and Laura Osnes is terrific, right?
I mean, yes, she is.
I think most recent thing I saw her in was Bandstand?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And, I mean, she's done a million
and
people,
so many,
but on Broadway, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I think she's like, and also I think
she shot a Hallmark movie, I think.
But was she also, maybe I'm losing it, but is she also in, like you, Fosse Verdon?
Yes, she is. Yes, she is.
Okay.
Yes, she was in Fosse Verdon as well. And so was Aya Cash, my old classmate from Minnesota.
There we go. Yeah, it's nice to highlight a few people.
Jessica Heck's husband directed my episode. Figure that one out.
There you
Adam
go.
Bernstein. Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, so that show went over very well, and you got your first Tony nomination, Best Actor in a Musical. And I think also you're, again, this person who at the time was your girlfriend, now your wife, was in it as well. Is that one that... you look back on as, I would think, it's probably a pretty hard to top one.
It's pretty great.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, our wedding, Jess went into the show, we overlapped for 3 weeks towards the end mm-hmm. of my first year. I just did a year, and then Jess came in and other people came in. But our wedding was in 2015, and it was primarily the cast of Cinderella. Vicky Clark sang. Peter Bartlett was our officiant.
Wow.
Yeah, Harriet Harris, all those people, Anna Rada, they were all there. Yeah.
And then you go off and do Frozen, and I sure any Disney movie is going to be a big deal, but did you have any sense this was a phenomenon?
No, I've said it before, I'll say it again. It feels like you're a sperm donor to a kid who becomes president. I mean, you were there. I was there 5 days, and one of those days was just sounds. So one day was just like, that was a day. So there are 4 days over 2.5 years of doing that. And then, then you're sitting next to children on the airplane that are watching it, or people dressed up. As I walked here, there was a giant Elsa, stuffed doll in Times Square. And I want to go say hi.
Well,
they don't get it.
A lot of Broadway folks were part of that, right? I mean, we got Josh Gad.
Yeah.
John Groff.
Kristen Bell had done.
Adina.
And Adina. Yeah.
Well,
Alan Tudyk.
So that was the good prince and the bad prince here. And then I think... one of the first times that I saw you would have been in Act One, which was a year later on Broadway opposite Tony Shalhoub, who was great in that as well. And again, now going from musical to a straight play, which That was even just the staging of that was interesting. You guys had such a complex, circular, revolving set and whatever. But I mean, when you work with somebody like a Tony Shalhoub, who's been doing it forever, are you the kind of person that will seek out advice, or is it just sort of, or, you know, input, or is it just sort of take in through osmosis what's there?
I mean, I think Tony's incredibly, not only generous, but incredibly approachable dude. They came to the show the other day. He's lovely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we played poker together. Like, it's any question I'd have, I'm sure he would be more than happy. And Andrea Martin as well, who's become also very close. She lives up by us. And Chuck Cooper was in that cast. I mean, that was, I always say about that show, it's not the work, it's the stairs. Because it was like two people who don't know, it was like a revolving set that I think won the Tony for Beowulf, mm-hmm. and two flights of stairs that I would run up and down, up and down, up and down.
Constantly.
And we did a Fitbit. We put a Fitbit on me. My dresser, Lauren Galatelli, who's still my dresser now, she was like, we're going to see how much. And we had bets. Yeah. And I think it ended up being like, I want to say either a mile and a half or 2 miles a show.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
God.
Yeah.
Okay. So this brings us to where probably people who can't spend much time in New York and who don't necessarily investigate who's voicing characters in movies they see, where they would have gotten to know you for the first time, and that would be Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Yep.
This is, of course, Greg Serrano, the gruff bartender, in 22 episodes spanning 2015, 2016. It's musical dramedy that's was on the CW. Aileen Brosh McKenna, Rachel Bloom. How'd you first hear about it, and what appealed to you about it?
I had an audition during Act One. And at first I was like, I don't think so. They don't want me. That's not, I'm not right for this. And Telsey cast it, and they brought me back in. They were like, please, please come in. We really think it's a good fit. I came in, played the piano, sang, did the scenes, improvised a lot, which was actually really fun. Mm-hmm. Got the pilot, Mark Webb directed. It was supposed to be for Showtime, you know, that whole story.
But that's interesting, because that would maybe affect your plans later. I mean, this was going to be a 30-minute Showtime comedy. That's quite
10
different.
Episode.
Yeah, 10 episodes. Quite different than, what would it be, a 20...
Up to 22, 24, you know, whatever they want.
Right.
I mean, an hour-long show, shooting an hour-long show is very different than shooting a half-hour show. I had not gotten married yet. Mm-hmm. My wife's whole is from Philadelphia. Her mm-hmm. family is here. Her friends are here. Her, you know.
Yeah.
It was tough.
Well, so for the season that you did, you made it work by... I mean, this was in L.A.
Yes.
Your wife's in a show in New York.
Yes.
Not easy at the beginning of a marriage.
Not easy. Not easy. And scary. Because you realize, you know, also, again, this goes back to Ken.
Right.
What are you doing and why are you doing it?
Right.
I want to tell great stories with great people and play great characters. And I want to do it because I think it's important that people unite behind common experiences and understanding what other people go through and step through. And you step into other people's shoes and you understand what they experience, and then people are able to empathize with that. That's it. And I love my wife.
That's a good reason.
Not only happy wife, happy life, but that's the life that we had. It just suddenly there was like, oh no, what's going to happen here? Are you going to stay in New York while I'm in LA for 6 more years, potentially? Mm-hmm. Are you going to move to LA where you know no one? And also, I realized, if I had been her, stepping into the shoes of my wife, mm-hmm. you meet this guy, you get married to this guy, you want to spend your life with them, and now they're saying, you got to move across the country where you know no one. Yeah.
Just to play devil's advocate, though, are you thinking at all to yourself, if I pull out of this opportunity, there's no guarantee that another one of this high profile comes along and I could be screwing myself?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, I thought everything. Yeah. I mean, the good thing is my agents were very smart. They knew, like, this isn't, it's very rare for a show to have a second chance like that, which is fantastic for the show. But they knew, and they said, you've got to make sure this is a 1-year contract because we know you.
Yeah.
And they knew I wasn't auditioning for things that would relocate you and potentially for 7 years of an hour-long show.
Right.
They knew me. So they said, we've got to make sure. And I was upfront and honest with them about that from the beginning.
Yeah.
So when that year was up and we were like, and also keep in mind, we had no idea if it was going to continue.
Yeah, it
continue.
Was not a guarantee at all.
No. So yes, I mean, I thought everything. I thought all of the worst scenarios and the best scenarios. And
the way it resolved was that airport.
Yeah, yeah, that's
which
right.
Was
in the second season.
Bow on the whole thing. And I guess they've now wrapped the show after four seasons.
Yeah, some of the cast, Vela and Dave were over at my place the other night, who plays Heather and White Josh. And Donalyn and I were texting the other day. But it sounds like it's kind of,
yeah.
I think, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, so you come back, and among other things, I know you've been involved with a few things over those, whatever, two or three years between that and Tootsie. But one of them, how did you end up with Bernadette Peters and Hello Dolly?
Yeah.
I know it's just a short period, but that is a fun show to watch. I don't know if it's a fun show to do.
It is.
Yeah?
It is. It's up there with this, with Tootsie.
Really?
I mean, I do think that also was one of those things. There was a TV show. There was some TV show I was up for that we were hoping was going to happen and end up falling apart. And I shot a pilot that also we had just found out we hadn't found out yet. Scott Rudin's office called my reps and were like, hey, would he be interested in like coming in for like a brief time to Hello Dolly? And initially, again, I was like, no, I'm not going to be good at that. I don't think I'll be good at, you get like 10 days of rehearsal.
Which part was this?
Cornelius. So we said no.
Right.
They came back and then they were like, well, would you go see it? What if we just got in tickets? And so we went and watched. And when Bernadette Peters sang, before the parade passes by, she has that monologue to her husband, her passed away husband. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I were both crying. Mm-hmm. And we were like, it's really good. It's really good.
And you didn't have to commit for that long.
It was 2 months. And it was summer stock on Broadway with Victor Garber and Bernadette Peters and Kate Baldwin. I mean, it's insane.
Right.
I was so lucky. And Jerry Zaks was fantastic. And Steve Edlund, his associate, who, you know, stepped me through it again. It was 10 days of prep. But it was, and that show.
Oh, that's amazing.
Is a joy.
So in there, I guess you do your Fosse Verdon episode as well.
Yep.
Which, I don't know, have you watched it?
I don't watch
it. It's going over huge.
No, it's great. Yeah. I hear it's great.
Yeah.
And I knew that from the writing.
Right.
Stephen
right.
Levinson. I mean, it's great.
But now this brings us to the featured attraction, which is Tootsie, which opened on Broadway, having already played in Chicago, opened on April 23rd. You're playing Michael Dorsey and Dorothy Michaels, these characters who people probably know first from the film Tootsie from 1982. Dustin Hoffman played it. But now the idea that they would turn a great comedy, I think according to the American Film Institute, the second greatest comedy of all time in terms of films, you're going to take it and make it into a musical and do it on Broadway. How did you even hear about it at the beginning?
Sure.
And would you have thought that this is something that you should pursue, or was it somebody else's idea?
It was not my idea. I had worked up at New York Stage and Film with Scott Ellis, mm-hmm. our director, mm-hmm. on something that I had written that he had directed, and we got along very well. I thought he was hilarious and smart and talented and also a deeply good man, mm-hmm. a great man, and thoughtful and generous. And I was like, that's good to remember, you know? And he called me, I think, a week later after we finished. And he said, I got a script. Will you read it? He told me it was Tootsie. I was like, oh, based on the movie one? And I kind of launched into a, like, you got to make sure whoever you get. I was like, you know, he can't just be a singer.
Right.
And he can't just be a comedian. And he can't just be an actor. Right. He has to, and he can't, you know, he has to also be able to sing. And he also, I like launched into this like, oh, that's a good part. You better make sure. He was like, I just called you. Will you read it? I was like, okay, yeah, I'll read it. And that was 3 years ago.
Yep.
And he said, let's just do the first reading mm-hmm. and we'll see what we think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the great thing is then I got to, and I'd met David Yazbek before, he didn't remember, but, and he shouldn't have. I got to meet Robert and David and the whole team of people who were incredibly collaborative and incredibly lovely.
And was David also in the midst of, I guess, the band's
visit? Well, I was in the very first reading of the band's visit before there was any music. With Tony Shalhoub.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And Hal Prince was directing that at the time. So it was like a very, I remember back then, I'd also done a reading of, I can say this, he won't care. He won't listen anyway. David won't listen to this. But of Animal House.
Yeah.
They were going to do Animal House as a musical.
Mm-hmm.
I did a reading of that that he had written some songs for. I don't think that's happening. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But, I mean, here's the bigger thing is,
right.
Do you know how many experiences I've been in with all those readings that go nowhere?
Yeah.
So this is another one of those. Like, all right, yeah, let's read it. Sounds like a good part. I mean, all I remembered from the movie, it came out the year I was born, so I didn't see it until much later mm-hmm. when I was a little kid, and I didn't remember it that well. I just remember, right. Oh, that's a great part.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So Scott called. I watched the movie then, and that was kind of it. The movie came on during the holidays with my family, and we kind of casually watched it, but that was it. So 3 years, I think we did 9 readings. over the process of the 3 years. And in the meantime, doing Fosse Verdon, doing all these pilots of things.
And the primary person that's propelling this, is that Scott Sanders?
Of course. Scott Sanders and Carol Fineman, who are our lead producers, are definitely leading the ship. Yeah. But Scott is
And people in L.A., who where a lot of our listeners are, I believe he's also... He directs a lot of TV. Yeah. He's done The Marvelous Ms. Maisel and all kinds of stuff.
Comedies, dramas. Yeah. He did the live Christmas Story live thing. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So in terms of now, you know, going through all these readings and whatever, in the course of doing that, I guess, even, like when you're doing a reading, are you, have you figured out the Dorothy voice?
No, you figured nothing out. No. You're just trying crap, basically. Yeah. You're like throwing shit at the wall and seeing what's going to stick, what doesn't. I did, when he called and we looked at the first... When I watched the movie the first time, there were three things that stuck out. Mm-hmm. She's from the South. There's a red dress. And the conflict is that he falls in love, but as someone that he is not.
Right.
That's it. That's the core of the story. So anything beyond that, I say, go for it. Up for grabs. Mm-hmm. And luckily, they agreed. I mean, I think it changed so many different ways. We tried. I tried a version of her as like a Minnesotan from my time in Minnesota, which was interesting. But we felt like... Why not? Just sell it. Right. What's the problem?
Right.
I'm not a great impressionist, so I wasn't worried about me doing an impression of Dustin Hoffman. Also, I didn't watch the movie that much, so I couldn't. I couldn't have if I tried.
Right.
And then it's a you know, it's a learning process. That's what's one of the great things about this is there were so many things we had to figure out. And to me, that's super exciting because I have lists of like, okay, here we go. I'm going to watch Women on the Subway. I'm going to talk to my mom and my sister about certain things that I never thought of asking them. I'm going to talk to my voice teacher about what is realistic 8 times a week. I'm going to start walking in those high heels with Leslie Flesner, who is in the ensemble of Hello Dolly, who is also the assistant dance captain now at Tootsie. She put me through my paces. You know, all of that's exciting.
Well, and I think one other thing that may have given you guys a little bit of trepidation, because I think it was unfolding as you guys were developing the show. We have the whole Me Too thing comes out. We have a society that's becoming more sensitive to gender politics and, you know, trends and all kinds of things. I know that you were actively making sure that the material was going to be, and that your performance was going to be respectful about that. Can you share what some of the steps were that you took?
Absolutely. A playwright friend of mine reached out to me, Winter Miller, who's a friend. I'd done a reading of hers, and she said, yo, I'm excited for you. I heard that you're doing this. I'm thrilled for you. I'm also terrified for you. And I really think, and she knew me. So she knew that she was talking to someone who wanted to listen. And she suggested we reach out to Gloria Steinem or Rebecca Traister. We reached out to Gloria Steinem, who was understandably very busy.
Yes.
But was lovely through Emily Mann, who's also a friend. I ended up Googling Rebecca Traister, who said Tootsie was her favorite movie, on Twitter. And I was like, oh, this is a sign.
That's it.
And then, and all I had seen, I mean, I had read articles that Rebecca had written, but I didn't know her work as well as I do now, of course. And then I looked her up on Twitter and saw that Kate Baldwin followed her. And she followed Kate Baldwin, who at the time, during Hello Dolly, I was making out with every night. So I went up to Kate and I was like, Kate, how do you know Rebecca? Why are you following Rebecca Traister? And why is Rebecca Traister following you?
Right.
She's like, oh, we went to college together. So, and my wife was like, it's Bashert. You have to reach out to her. And I did. We had lunch and we talked about the movie. We also ended up, she spoke at Michael Friedman's, this is so insidery, but this is a,
that's what it is.
She spoke at Michael Friedman's funeral that I was at in Philadelphia, which was at Germantown Friends School, which is the school that both Michael Friedman went to, Rebecca Traister went to, and my wife went to.
Oh my God.
So I was there and then we had lunch and I was like, oh my gosh, you were the person who spoke at the funeral. And I had done readings of some of Michael's stuff and loved him. And I said, I told her, I was like, listen, I like to think of myself as a progressive guy. I know there are things I know I don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I started reading all of her stuff. She started, she just kind of drilled into me. It stuck with me that the physical stuff is fine and funny and real. But the bigger stuff is the stuff that is inbred into society that you don't think about. And my awareness level just exploded.
Well, so the thing that everybody remembers about Tootsie, the movie, even if they haven't yet seen the show, where it comes up again is, you know, essentially I'm paraphrasing, but like it took me being a woman to learn
How to
be a better man.
I was a better man with you as a woman than I ever was with a woman as a man.
Yes.
I just have to learn how to do it all without the dress. I think that's Larry Gelbart from the movie.
Yes. Yeah. And so that's Michael Dorsey's experience. Is that also Santino Fontana's experience?
I mean, not to the same degree. Yeah. I will say Michael Dorsey has zero emotional intelligence and is completely unaware of people outside of himself at the beginning of the story.
Yes.
That's not me.
No, I just mean the idea that
you see the world differently.
Yeah.
How could you? But it's the same with any role.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
If you're really paying attention and you're really being honest about trying to step into somebody else's shoes,
right,
you're going to learn more about yourself and humanity.
Yeah.
I mean, we're never asked. There are three men in this room right now, yeah, for people who can't see. No one is ever asking us, hey, do you want us to walk you to the subway at 1 a.m?
Mm-hmm.
You know, drill down on that. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, like for a woman to walk outside, mm-hmm, is dangerous later? What the fuck?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's the stuff. The fact that equal pay for equal work is not... I could go on.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm at stores in the city, and I hear a guy start giving a woman behind the counter a harder time than she deserves or anyone, mm-hmm, deserves. And my trigger finger gets real. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Stop it, mm-hmm, dude. Stop it.
Did you, as you were developing the look of the character and the, you know, figuring out how you're going to walk and all the things that you have to do here, did you actually go out in the world?
No, absolutely not. No, what we're doing is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I also knew, in the same way, that the biggest thing that I envy about the people who had the experience of making the film, mm-hmm, is they had hours and hours and hours and hours in a makeup trailer.
Yeah.
I have 10 seconds.
Oh, it's amazing, the turnarounds.
Yeah, it's a lot. But don't get too close, you know? Which is fine, because also, I will also say, there are all different types of women. There,
right,
are women who look all different ways.
Right.
There's not one type of way that a woman looks or sounds.
Right.
So the canvas is broad.
Right.
But if you are playing somebody who's trying to defraud others of who he actually is, you're not going to want them to get too close either.
No.
And you're also constantly terrified.
Right.
So Michael Dorsey is not swimming through this experience.
No.
He's terrified every step of the way. When he starts getting successful, it gets to his head, and then his life falls apart. You know, that's the story.
True. This is, I have said this without you, so I feel like I could say it with you and not be brown-nosing. This is the most fun, my favorite show of the season. And the moment that the producer today, we went and saw it together, and the moment that I was won over and I just smiled the whole way through was "I Won't Let You Down," this song where we first really see you blossoming,
yeah,
as Dorothy and singing in that voice, because you see that you've, you know, that's what the do or die moment, right?
Yeah.
If you couldn't pull that off,
we're screwed.
You're screwed, right?
Yeah.
And you just killed it. So thanks. How long did it take to get to a point where you could sing beautifully, not just as yourself, but now as a totally different person?
Yeah. It took time. I mean, Joan Lader is my voice teacher. She had me sing that song in every key. And then we listened back and just listened to, because comedy's in the contrast, mm-hmm, right? So, and the movie, people who did the movie did that, anybody knows that. So that we have to have a big contrast between Michael and Dorothy,
mm-hmm,
in order for it to be more believable and funnier. And then what's really achievable 8 times a week? Which,
well, that's what,
you know,
I was gonna ask.
It's unprecedented in some ways.
Yeah.
Like, and Joan said this to me the other day. This week is particularly hard because we didn't have a day off in these 2 weeks. We were going straight. So tonight's show will be show 14 of 16 in a row. So it's never going to get harder than this.
Yeah.
But the guy who sings in Little Mary Sunshine, he's not also singing as a man for,
right,
the other 50% of the show.
Right.
So we're kind of in new, like, we don't,
yeah,
know. We,
well,
don't really,
so,
know.
What's it done to your voice? How do you maintain your voice?
I just take care of myself. I mean, you take care of yourself. I'm incredibly aware of my body and my, you know, I have an amazing support team at the theater. Brian Strumwasser and Lauren Galatelli and Margot Lawley, all the dressers, all of the people backstage, Scott Rollis and the stage management team, and Scott Ellis, and everyone's aware that we're kind of like, how you doing? Do we need water? What do you need?
And do you have a firm end date yet, or are you going to ride this as long as you can?
I think we all signed a year contract, which is pretty standard.
Yeah.
You know,
and you
of
think
course,
the voice can hold up for a year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, you know, the great thing is that I want to like teach a class on like long runs, because, mm-hmm, no one teaches you how to do that.
Well, what's the most
actors
important?
Are taught how to struggle. how to audition, how to fight, how to get an opportunity. But they're not taught, once you get in the door, how do you not only keep make it last, but continue to fulfill yourself as an artist to sustain yourself over a long time? We're not taught that.
Well, so, you know, I will say that the thing, I've heard enough actors explain this that I accept that I was wrong with my initial feeling. But my initial feeling was that doing anything 8 times a week over a year for 3 hours at a time is going to get tiresome.
Absolutely. That's
not only physically, but just mentally.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, every other performance career, mm-hmm. baseball, football, basketball, and they all have, guess what? Off season.
Yeah. Right.
You know, we're up there 8 times a week, 6 days a week. There's one day off. Of course, it's going to get tiring. So what we have to figure out is, how can you prevent the snowball? That's the big name of the game. Prevent the snowball. What starts as a sneeze develops into a cough, develops into bronchitis in a week if you don't watch it. Or you've got a pain. I mean, I got cupped on my leg. I'll show you. You can't see it. But I have cupping all over my leg. Oh, my shaved legs, by the way, because what we're realizing is Dorothy bevels into her left hip more than her right.
Oh.
So over time, my left leg is grabbing on more than it needs to, which then climbs up to my waist, which climbs up to my shoulder, which climbs up to my neck, which then, you know, it's that crap.
But you're talking about a physical snowball. What I would be afraid of, and this is maybe because I don't have years and years of already doing this, is the mental snowball, which is, even if it's a great show, which this certainly is, even if it's a great part, which this certainly is, just does the repetitiveness of it wear you down?
I wouldn't say wears you down. It's a challenge but it's also the fun part, because no moment is the same.
Okay.
You could ask that question you just asked me again. It would not be the same. It can't be.
Right.
You're not a machine.
Right.
So there's going to be a difference. And my job as the actor to not lie to you is to acknowledge what actually happened and respond in kind with, what is that moment actually about?
Right.
And what does that character want from this other character? What is our relationship and what actually happened? And then how are we going to move from there? That's fun. I mean, that's why I'm an actor. I mean, that's why I can't picture myself ever. Hey, trust me. I've taken the LSATs. I thought about getting out. The idea, when I think of that, just the excitement level of being able to play a moment, whether it's on camera and the script doesn't change. You're saying the same scene.
Right.
We're doing 4 takes, 5 takes, 10 takes, 12 takes. You're doing the show for 400 performances straight. Every time you step up to that moment, you have the opportunity to breathe life into it, which cannot be repeated. And that is thrilling, because it unites an audience who just saw it. And they know when it's fake and it's not. And
you do too. That attitude goes back to Guthrie.
Ken. Yeah. That's all Ken. Yeah. 100%.
Last question. We sit here 10 days away from the Tonys.
I see a theme.
There is a theme here. I mean, this show has been a phenomenon. The reviews couldn't be better, making more than $1 million a week, which is a milestone not many shows ever get to. 11 Tony nominations, including Best Musical and Best Actor in a Musical. All of this. What have these last few weeks been like for you? And what do you anticipate? You know, how do you follow this?
Listen, like I said earlier, I've been luckily within these 10 blocks where we are right now. You know, the Snapple Theater, where I did Fantastics, is across the street. Mm-hmm. I've been within these 10, 14 blocks since I moved here in 2006. And it's lovely to be seen and to be recognized and to be a part of a community of artists who I also admire and am honored to be within, to be considered amongst them. So that's all lovely. Mm-hmm. And these last couple of weeks have been exciting and tiring, mm-hmm. and surprising and all of the above. Beyond this, I think you probably will know more than I from the outside. I'm in it. So I'm just trying to, you know, I've got work to do. We've got, like, it's not over.
No.
And
no.
I do think, you know, someone said, this always happens though. After Sons of the Prophet, there was, I got all these scripts, and the scripts were always, I'm dying. And the last scene I cry. And I was like, we got to get out of this. And, it, you know, you'd be surprised. Right. Now, the thing that people are talking about, like, oh, so like a big, like, high-octane comedy TV show. Like, we literally just did that. Or something deal with gender politics. And, like, right. We literally just did that.
Yeah.
I don't think anything changes from my point of view in terms of great stories, great characters, great working with great people. And, you know, trying to continue to chase that passion of what I love to do. I don't think I can do anything else. I think any idea that you can is lunacy because you can't control it. You can't. I don't think.
Well, thank you so much and keep up the great work. It was a treat to get to see it. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Finally, be sure to check out the other podcasts that are part of the Hollywood Reporter's podcast network, all of which are excellent. Leslie Goldberg and Daniel Feinberg's TV's Top 5, Seth Abramovich and Chip Pope's It Happened in Hollywood, Carolyn Giardina's Behind the Screen, and Josh Wigler's Series Regular. On behalf of all of us at The Hollywood Reporter, thanks for tuning in.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.